Mr. Braun, if you are ready, let's go. Ready as ever. Okay.
May it please the court. Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is James Braun, and I'm an assistant United States attorney in Albuquerque. The defendant in this case is charged with distribution of heroin resulting in the death of Cameron Weiss. Now, after Cameron Weiss's death in August of 2011, the Office of the Medical Investigator conducted a routine autopsy, and as part of that, they sent off blood and urine samples to a contract laboratory in Pennsylvania called NMS Labs. And there, 15 or so lab technicians subjected the samples to testing, and the instruments that were used printed out the results of the testing, some 900 or so pages of graphs and data. One of the technicians, and her title was certifying scientist, named Don Sherwood, summarized that data in a seven-page toxicology report, and that report was sent back to OMI. About 3 years later, as part of the government's investigation into Cameron Weiss's death, the government asked Dr. Laura LeBay, a forensic toxicologist at NMS Labs, to provide her opinion on the cause of death. And Dr. LeBay looked at a number of documents, including transcripts of grand jury testimony, reports of witness interviews, and the toxicology report. And she came to the conclusion that the cause of death was heroin toxicity. Now, after the defendant was indicted and the case was proceeding towards trial, the government filed its exhibit list, which included the toxicology report, along with a certificate of authentication for its admission into evidence. And the government also filed its notice of expert witnesses, listing Dr. LeBay and Dr. Sam Andrews from OMI, the forensic pathologist. As the case got closer to trial, the prosecutors decided that they should call Ms. Sherwood herself to introduce the toxicology report. She was listed on the defense witness list, but she wasn't available for trial during the scheduled trial dates, and so the prosecutors reached out to defense counsel about conducting a pre-trial deposition, a video deposition.
Why did you ask for a continuance?
Well, because what we believed was
just
possible
to the wicker factors and
was to conduct a pre-trial deposition, a video deposition, and do it that way. By the time we got to analyzing the wicker factors, when the defense had moved to exclude Ms. Sherwood's testimony,
that was only like a couple days later, though.
Right.
It's not a long time after that.
It happened very fast, yes. But
this is all close to trial.
It's approximately 2 weeks away from trial, yes. And by the time we got to analyzing those factors, the government had said, look, we'll call Ms. Sherwood, we'll have her at trial. So the deposition wasn't really an issue then. What had become the issue more was the idea that she was an expert witness, Ms. Sherwood was, and the government hadn't timely notified the defense of her status as an expert witness. And ultimately, the defense moved to exclude her on that basis, and the court agreed and excluded her from testifying. So at that point, the prosecutors went to Dr. LeBay. She had been at the NMS lab for years. She was a forensic doctor.
And she'd been listed as a potential witness prior?
She had. She had been listed as actually noticed up under Rule 16 as an expert witness to provide testimony about the cause of death. And one of the documents she had reviewed was the toxicology report. Prosecutors asked her if she could look at the underlying data and reach her own conclusion about the results of those tests. And sure enough, she could. And the government proffered that testimony to the court. The defense objected, arguing that
when she did that, was she simply accepting the reliability of that data, or was she independently verifying, certifying its reliability?
She would have to assume its reliability the same way Ms. Sherwood would have had to assume it for all of the technicians who performed tests other than her. And certainly that would go to authenticating the data, mm-hmm. but it doesn't go to its admissibility as far as the hearsay rules and the confrontation clause.
So she would have assumed its reliability.
Right, as an expert is allowed to do, and she would have
And anything further than that?
she would have had to, she would have testified about the overall process at the lab, how samples come into the lab, how they are tested, how the machines work, based on, she was the assistant director of the lab, I believe. She would have testified about all of that. Now, she
the same things that Sherwood would have testified to.
Right, right. But she, and she was certainly qualified to offer that testimony. Now, as far as chain of custody and other authentication type issues that aren't really at issue here, the government would, of course, have had to have established that through either another witness or through Dr. LeVay herself. And that's something that wouldn't have required expert testimony. Mm-hmm. And the government's witness list still wasn't due yet at the time this had come about. So depending on how the court ruled on some of these issues, the government could have identified a chain of custody witness to fill in those gaps as might have been required. But as far as the Confrontation Clause analysis, Dr. LeVay, totally aside from Ms. Sherwood's report, could have looked at the underlying data, really the same as Ms. Sherwood did.
It wouldn't you'd concede it wouldn't come in without either Sherwood or LeVay to sponsor the exhibit?
Well, the government at that point did not intend to introduce the underlying data itself, and it had agreed not to introduce Ms. Sherwood's report. Now, arguably, that was being ultra-conservative. That was going above and beyond what the Constitution requires, because the report is not testimonial hearsay.
Why not?
Because
under Bull Cummings, why it under, seems like it is.
Under Bull Cummings and Melendez-Diaz, those cases involved reports that had a certification component to them that were produced with the idea that they would be used in a criminal prosecution, whether it was for DWI or for something else that involved a prosecution. Here, this is performed by a third-party lab with regard to an autopsy. The criminal prosecution in this case didn't come until 3 years later.
Is the key the purpose of why the report was generated? I mean, you know, what's the rule you're asking us to set forth in this case, and what's kind of the best Supreme Court case that you would rely on? Because we'll have to distinguish Bull Cummings, Melendez, Williams is kind of quirky, but well, is it a primary purpose test, or is it because the timing of the prosecution came years after the report was generated? What's the critical factors for us?
Well, it's really the test for determining whether an out-of-court statement is testimonial. And Williams provides support for holding that this report was not testimonial. In Williams, five justices would have held that way. The four justices in the plurality plus Justice Thomas would have held that the DNA report at issue there, even though it was discussed at the trial, was not testimonial hearsay and would not have violated the Confrontation Clause. But here, the court doesn't necessarily need to do that. That would certainly be helpful. But here, the government had affirmatively foregone introducing that report. And so really what we were looking at is the underlying data at that point. And Dr. LeVay's reliance on the underlying data, that data is not hearsay at all. Under this court's holding in Hamilton and Channon more recently, just several weeks ago, that machine-generated information is not hearsay. It's not a statement intended to assert anything.
Well, why isn't that true of the, you know, the test that detected cocaine in Melendez and the test that detected alcohol in Bull Cummings?
Because what's different here is that in each of those cases, the government actually introduced the report. So they didn't introduce just the underlying data. They introduced the report that was prepared saying, this is cocaine. And that's what the court held violated the Confrontation Clause.
Well, then to evade the Confrontation Clause, the prosecution would just ignore the report, have the expert stand up, you know, and say, you know, it was cocaine, alcohol, a DNA match.
But that's actually perfectly complying with the Confrontation Clause, because that witness is then subject to cross-examination about her qualifications and about what she reviewed. And by reviewing that underlying data, she is performing what an expert performs, which is using her expertise to look at the data that was generated by these machines and come to a conclusion. And that conclusion is subject to cross-examination.
So I Is that the same position that you took below? Have you refined your position a little bit?
Well, we certainly refined it, I believe, just because of
that
how
happens.
Fast
it's happening.
But,
yeah.
No, our position below was we will not introduce Ms. Sherwood's report. We will have – now, this is assuming that Ms. Sherwood was excluded. This was Plan B.
Right, right.
Now, assuming that's the case, then what we offered to do was have Dr. LeBay independently look at the underlying data, just like Ms. Sherwood had, and come to her own independent conclusion. And under Camahile and Garcia, that is entirely appropriate. That's what experts are allowed to do. They're allowed to rely on – in fact, even assuming this was hearsay, that the data was hearsay, inadmissible hearsay, which it's not – but even if it was, she is allowed to rely on that under Rule 703 and under Camahile and Garcia because she's looking at that data, applying her own independent judgment, and coming to the conclusion about what that data shows as far as the substances that were in Cameron Weiss's blood and urine. And so that's entirely consistent with this Court's decisions regarding expert testimony. It's entirely consistent with Williams and with the confrontation claim.
Would your position be the same if the, you know, that analysis was, if the lab report was generated for the purpose of a prosecution, you know, just assume that it was done for that purpose. You know, they were going to retest the sample after Mr. Moya was arrested to confirm it. Would your position be the same that an expert could still go and review that and it would be permissible as independent expert testimony under 703?
It wouldn't be permissible for the if the expert was relying on testimonial hearsay for the expert to just parrot what was in the report, a summary of the data. But here, what we've offered to do is not introduce the report at all, to go behind the report to look at the underlying data that the report was based on. So in essence, it would be Dr. LeBay generating her own report, except at that point, she didn't have time to write a report. She was just going to testify, as is permissible, that she had reviewed the underlying data, and which is not hearsay. And again, even if it was, it is something that an expert can rely on as long as she is exercising her own independent judgment to come to a conclusion.
But looking at the report, I mean, it's a blood and urine sample, right? Just a chemical analysis of what was in the blood and urine.
Right, right. As far as
so, what's the underlying data that you're talking about?
The underlying data is 900 or so pages of charts and data, basically the printout from the GCMS and the other instruments that were used. That basically the samples were fed into these machines. The machines do the analysis and they spit out the results. Now, obviously, a lot goes into it as far as calibration and all of those things, but that's what goes to the authentication. That doesn't go to the admissibility under hearsay rules in the Confrontation Clause. And so that's the data, those 900 or some pages, that Dr. LeBay would be reviewing and testifying.
That would be true of any report of this type. And I just come back to the blood samples and the drug cocaine samples in Melendez.
Right. And if the government was trying to introduce the report itself, then Melendez, Diaz, and Bullcoming would be directly on point. And then the question would be, is the report testimonial? Was the primary purpose for its use in a criminal prosecution? That would be the issue. But here, we're not introducing the report. And so that's not really the question. Putting the report aside, we're basically having Dr. LeBay re-perform the analysis on her own and herself then be subject to cross-examination based on her qualifications and the reliability of her analysis of that data.
Counsel, can I just repeat what you're saying and let me see if I have it correct? You're saying as long as there's simply data, no interpretation, no report, no comment, nothing, that is purely admissible right there. The expert can rely on it.
That's exactly right.
Okay,
yes.
Thank you.
Now, of course, before we get to Dr. LeBay, we have the issue of Ms. Sherwood and whether her testimony should have been excluded. And our position is that the district court abused its discretion in applying the three Wicker factors, that the reason for the delay, and I think that our conversation this afternoon shows, that it wasn't necessarily sloppiness. I think it's confusion over the admissibility of this type of evidence and the best way to admit it.
Well, counsel, can I just ask you, because your time is short then, if we go down this path, and we say you're correct on that ground that there was an abuse, is that it, isn't it? Or do we have to go on to the Confrontation Clause issue?
If the court were to rule that the district court abused its discretion with Ms. Sherwood and that her testimony is admissible and her report would then be admissible through her, then it would not need to decide the Dr. LaVey issue. If I could reserve 5 seconds for rebuttal.
I'll give you some rebuttal time.
Thank you.
You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good afternoon. May it please the court, counsel. Your Honor, my name is Amy Serignano, and with Jerry Herrera, we both represent Raymond Moya at the district court level and here on this appeal. And, Your Honor, I'd like to start with the Wicker test and Rule 16. The district court did not abuse its discretion in excluding Chemist Dawn Sherwood after the government failed to comply with its rule, its disclosure requirements under Rule 16A1G. And our discovery order in this case was issued on July 1st of 2015. Mr. Herrera started the case 6 months or more before I joined the case, and the government knew what its Rule 16 discovery obligations were, because twice previously to this issue of Dawn Sherwood, they had filed a expert notice for the OMI medical examiner, Dr. LaVey herself, and then a second time when they noticed up under Rule 16 their DEA expert for some other chemical analysis.
What was the prejudice, though, that was generated by the deadline?
Using the Wicker factors, Judge? So, Judge, we have been arguing prejudice. The prejudice was that this trial had been continued a number of times, and the prejudice was that...
Well, counsel, I'm sorry. Can I just jump in there? But it had been continued at your client's request, hadn't it?
Correct. There were a number of opposed motions to continue. Due to discovery problems, we had to file another discovery motion, a supplemental motion, asking for scientific materials, asking for chain of custody, asking for policies and procedures regarding the SMS lab testing, and we did not receive any of that. We had a discovery dump of Giglio material in the January trial. We requested a continuance, raising ineffective assistance of counsel grounds because we weren't able to go through 2,500 pages days before trial. There was a continuance, a number of continuance, but most notably, it was the November continuance where we had requested a January trial date, the January 9th continuance, and the January 10th continuance. And we had all gotten together specifically because our experts testify nationwide. And the government knew that our expert, Dr. Pike, needed at least 6 weeks to get a time to testify. So, Judge Tinkovich, to answer your question regarding prejudice, the prejudice was that we didn't know what Chemist Sherwood was going to testify to specifically because we didn't have a written Rule 16, a formal report going through her bases, the reasons for her.
It wasn't much of a mystery, though, was it?
No, Your Honor, it wasn't a mystery, but it wasn't formalized in the proper format for Rule 16. We needed all of these documents. And, Judge, you wrote in U.S. versus Nevels back in 2007 that additional time was needed in order to do a proper cross-examination of a witness and also to get helpful impeachment evidence to properly cross-examine a witness, which is what we needed at that time. We weren't 2 weeks before trial. We were days. The government filed their emergency motion when it realized that they had neglected to properly notice Chemist Sherwood. And the court's schedule was so tight, we didn't get to the hearing until March 28th.
The other wicker factor was the availability of a continuance. Why wouldn't that have solved all the problems here?
Judge, the government relies on the Golansky opinion, and it does say that the continuance is the preferred sanction. Well, I submit that if you look at the Russell opinion and you look at the Banks opinion and you look at your opinion in Sandoval in 2017, Your Honor, that the court has the discretion to not impose a continuance. The court to maintain its schedule and maintain its integrity. Prejudice isn't even an issue, and that's Russell at 1512. Russell states, quote, "It may be appropriate for a district court to suppress evidence that did not comply with discovery orders to maintain the integrity and the schedule of the court." And that's what happened here. If you look at the argument on March 28th, it's document, the transcript's document 246, Judge Herrera goes through, she'd like to continue.
Neither party asked for a continuance, right?
That's correct. Your Honor, it would have been impossible.
Did she have an obligation to consider that independently of the party's position?
I think as part of her analysis, which...
Did she?
Yes, I think she did. The case had been continued so many times. The prejudice was that there was no way to get this case back on track with all the experts, with all the parties, and with the court. And the court wanted to move on, get this case tried. The April 6th trial setting was set on January 27th. After everybody came together, all the witnesses, all the experts, and the court to block out that time to try this case. And so while we did plead prejudice, I don't believe under those cases that I just cited that we had to. The court has the discretion and under Rule 16 also has, you know, the discretion to enter any order that's just under the circumstances to exclude or continue or to compel more discovery when there's been a Rule 16 violation.
Turning to the Dr. LeBay issue, it seems to me that, you know, tell me if I'm wrong, but in New Mexico, autopsies are performed for, I guess, a class of deaths. It wasn't briefed when an autopsy occurs, but in this case, one was performed. It wasn't targeted at identifying Mr. Moya. I don't think there was any direct evidence that a crime had been committed. In fact, Moya wasn't charged for several years later. I understand that. Why would under the Supreme Court case all this be considered testimonial at all?
Your Honor, I spent a lot of time looking at that point, and I think you have to go back to Crawford, Melendez-Diaz, and Bullcoming, that this information is hearsay and it's testimonial and it can't come in under a exception to the hearsay rules. There's a couple of things that
how does it meet the primary purpose test that we addressed with the government?
I'm sorry,
how does it meet the idea that a reasonable certifying analyst could assume that the primary purpose would be for introduction in a criminal prosecution or for investigation? How does it meet that? And do you think it has to meet that?
Yes, I do.
How does it meet that?
And I think it's distinguishable from, you said, this quirky case, the plurality opinion.
Williams.
There was an OMI investigator on the scene and also worked this autopsy through. Okay? The lab samples... The samples were taken from the decedent, sent to the lab, not only for
cause of
death determination, But it's reasonable to assume that Dawn Sherwood, the other 15 analysts, that's why they write a toxicology report. Down the road, if there's an investigation, the OMI investigator was there, if there's a subsequent prosecution, that report would end up...
Any evidence or anything in the record to establish that that's why they did that?
No.
3 years earlier?
No. What is in the record is that Mr. Moya had been prosecuted by the government before and pled to an 11C1C case, and it came out that they were going to bring up this subsequent death investigation post-plea and sentencing before Judge Vasquez.
Doesn't that make every autopsy report testimonial? Because it's conceivable that it could lead to a criminal prosecution.
If that autopsy report comes in a subsequent prosecution, then, Your Honor, I believe it would be.
So it's never non-testimonial.
If it involves
in a criminal case.
If it involves, you're saying if it involves narcotics or illegal substances, it could, an autopsy report will never be non-testimonial?
No, what I'm saying is that if there is an autopsy report used in a criminal case to prove an out-of-court statement that's going to be used to prove the truth of the matter asserted, which was that the narcotics that were sold...
I understand how it ultimately was used. I'm trying to figure out if a person could have reasonably expected it to be used that way at the time that
right,
the report was generated. That's what seems to matter.
Crawford talks about if it's not anticipated to be used in a prosecution, then it's non-testimonial.
Well, but the issue
like
here is that the government was the one that caused the delay. Okay, this happened in 2011, right? They were the ones that chose not to prosecute that case initially. They waited until 2015 after Mr. Moya's first case was concluded, and then subsequently, and punitively, in my opinion, charged him with this heroin trafficking resulting in death. So we shouldn't be penalized, the defense, that there's a gap, 2011 to 2015. I believe it's reasonable for a forensic toxicologist who's doing a death investigation and there's illegal substances in a body, right, that's later and generates a report. That report is later used by a toxicologist. The toxicologist says the manner of death was heroin overdose, heroin toxicity, which ends up on a death certificate by the chief medical examiner.
You're running short of time. Could you also address his alternative argument? It's not testimonial because this LeBay was only going to rely, as I understand his argument, she was only going to rely on the underlying data and nothing else. What about that?
Judge, my problem with this argument is that it's really not fully developed in the record below. We only got a proffer from the assistant United States attorney that this was what Dr. LeBay was going to do, an independent review. She's contaminated Dr. LeBay.
Did the proffer indicate she would review only the underlying data, machine-generated data?
That was what the government proffered. Okay. Our position is that she can't do that. She's already contaminated. I included in our brief that she looked at the Sherwood report, document number one, considered that report in her findings. She has to. She is a PhD chemist, but at this point in the game, days before trial, she didn't issue a new report, which is circumspect to me. And also,
essentially, would she be testifying as an expert witness on a new topic or a new? Is that what you're suggesting?
Yes. It would be completely
if
distinct
she's
and different.
Different than what she was planning to testify, which was to accept the report that would have been in evidence.
And she had three prior reports to that, and she could have easily generated another report. The other issue that I have problems with, there's two, actually. I'm short of time. One is the idea that she would not be parroting under Kamehele. And that's what the district court used to keep her, exclude her from testifying. She absolutely, since she's contaminated, would have to, in some way, look at Sherwood's findings.
Why?
The chain of custody, because that's how the tests were run. She could look at 900 pages of GRASS chromatograph mass spectrometry sheets, which my expert did, but at that point in time, she already knew what the results were, okay?
Counsel, can I just stop you there? But I think just if you could respond to this, I think your opposing counsel would say, you can bring that all out. She'll be there. You can tell, you can ask her about already being contaminated. Can I get you to address that?
Yes, I agree, under cross-examination. The issue is that she would simply be parroting what she already knows, bringing a testimonial fact in to prove the truth of the matter asserted at trial. And this idea that the machine is the declarant and the witness isn't the declarant and that the government isn't going to put any reports into evidence in trial literally was developed 5 minutes before the March 30th hearing. We didn't really get an opportunity to brief a response to that properly because the motion, and the record shows, the motion was filed, and boom, we were before the district court with this new theory from the government.
Well, you won. You won.
We did, Your Honor, and I'm hopeful that we'll win again. But the issue is that this was a new idea that the government developed minutes before we walked into district court. They weren't going to put the Sherwood report into evidence. They weren't going to put the
they were going to. Did they say they would put chain of custody authentication type evidence on, as he described today?
Well, they would have to.
They had to.
They would have to. That's the only way that they would be able to get any kind of testimony into evidence, and for the confrontation clause, it would have to be a live witness. So Sherwood is excluded at this point, and so they would have to come up with somebody who received the samples, who tested the samples, and then, of course, certify the samples. Your Honor, I'm out of time.
Any other questions? Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Patrick, why don't you give Mr. Braun 2 minutes? 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, with regard to Wicker and the prejudice factor, the defendant is asking the court to put form over substance and basically arguing that because the government did not list Ms. Sherwood in the appropriate way, that that means he was prejudiced. Well, the substance of her report, there was never any question that that was going to come into evidence. The United States had provided that report to the defense over a year before the trial date. It had provided the underlying data, the 900 and some pages, to the defense well before trial. The defendant had already used that report, the toxicology report, to hire his own experts. Those experts had used the report to come up with a contrary opinion on cause of death and to challenge the reliability of the report. So he was fully prepared to meet the substance of the report. The United States had listed the report on its exhibit list, along with a certificate of authentication. There was never a question that that's what the government intended to do. It was just a matter of how it was going to be introduced. And especially in the circumstances of this type of evidence, where it really is unclear sometimes how one should go about introducing this type of evidence, if it can come in as a business record or if it's testimonial hearsay for which you have to have a live witness. Here, the government ultimately chose to take the more conservative approach and call the live witness. But under these circumstances, that did not result in any prejudice to the defendant because he should have been fully prepared to meet the substance of that information. Now, that leads into the idea that a continuance would have cured the prejudice. Really, a continuance wasn't necessary because of the lack of prejudice, and especially where the defendant was saying he didn't want a continuance and that he would be prepared to go forward even if Ms. Sherwood testified. Now, Judge Timkovich asked about when OMI conducts an autopsy. I see I'm out of time, but that would be in the government's opening brief at footnote 3.
Why don't you since we're not pressed for time, why don't you just tell me what footnote 3 says?
It says, OMI, and then this is in quotes, investigates any death occurring in the state of New Mexico that is sudden, violent, untimely, unexpected, or where a person is found dead and the cause of death is unknown. The OMI determines the cause and manner of death in these cases and provides formal death certification.
Does that require any referral from law enforcement, or is that, you know, kind of the charge of the state medical examiner to?
According to OMI, that's their charge. I can't answer the question if it requires a law enforcement referral. I don't believe that it does. But I would imagine that law enforcement would generally be involved in
sure.
in starting the OMI investigation. But it could be from a car accident. It could be a heart attack, I suppose. It could be a number of things that don't necessarily involve the idea of criminality.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that this case wasn't prosecuted for 3 years, I think part of that is because of the difficulty in putting a case like this together.
Okay. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Time's expired, and the case shall be submitted. Counsel are excused. Thank you for coming this afternoon, and the court will be in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.